2 months after the Buddha attained enlightenment, total, what can be called total freedom from suffering, he delivered his first Dharma discourse in the Deer Park in Sarnath, India, to the 5 ascetics that he'd been practicing with for about 6 years, practicing various extreme austerities prior to his enlightenment. That wasn't what enlightened him. He began turning the wheel of the Dharma, what we call the middle way, free of the extremes of self-mortification and self-indulgence 2,500 years ago. In his first discourse, one of the things he said was, "I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering." The Buddha taught that suffering is intrinsic to our human condition, or at least until we wake up to the true nature of life, the true nature of ourselves, that suffering is intrinsic to the human condition. And of course, when the Buddha said, "I teach suffering," he wasn't recommending suffering, and he wasn't about to tell his students the best way to suffer. They already knew that. What he was doing was pointing out the truth of its existence, and that until we look at it directly and honestly, at the reality of suffering in our lives, we aren't able to take the necessary steps to free ourselves from it. One aspect of what is called suffering is the suffering of painful experiences. Anywhere in the world, here in Israel and the United States, anywhere, really, we see poverty, we see hunger, we see people living in extremely dirty, unsanitary, very difficult conditions. And maybe in relation to this, we feel things. We might feel sadness, we might feel anger. We might feel frustrated, we might feel confused, we might even feel doubtful in some way. Maybe the foundations of our beliefs, our opinions, our security gets shaken up when we see this kind of suffering. Our own bodily conditions, with all of our various discomforts, our aches and our pains. Maybe we have respiratory problems, digestive problems, various illnesses at any given time. All of this can be called the suffering of painful experience. And it's probably what most people think of as suffering when it's looked at, when it's thought about. There's another aspect of difficulty, of suffering, that begins to become more apparent as our practice begins to take root, as we begin to notice things more deeply in our vipassana practice, and also as we open in the metta and compassion practice. This our incessantly changing likes, our incessantly changing dislikes, our changing wants, our changing rejections of this or that, In this, we're beginning to touch the suffering of delusion. This underlying hope that possessing things, people, various experiences will give us some kind of an unchanging, permanent, pleasurable state. The suffering of delusion. This particular aspect of difficulty, of suffering, isn't always so apparent to us as we kind of blithely go about our life, accumulating in our lives, accumulating people, relationships, things, experiences, with this underlying hope that they'll give us some permanent satisfaction. But the truth of the matter is that all experiences, all things are transitory. So as we begin to see more clearly, we begin to notice that there's a suffering in this trying to hold on, a kind of constant tension, a constant dissatisfaction within ourselves. If we ignore this inherent, transitory, and uncertain nature of life, both within us and everywhere, all around us. So the second aspect of difficulty, of suffering. The third is maybe the most subtle and yet the most pervasive. And this is the suffering that's inherent in ignoring the truth that everything in this world, everything in this universe, comes into being through the combination of a multitude of conditions. Everything is contingent. Everything is relative, related. Everything is in relationship, contingent. And we very often take the opposite of this to be true. Taking our experiences, taking things to be separate, solid, happenings, separate, solid forms in and of themselves. And we hold on. We hold on to the past, we hold on to the present, and we even solidify and hold on to the possible future. Everything comes into being through the combination of a multitude of conditions. And if we try to hold on, it inevitably eventually creates suffering for ourselves and for others. But fortunately, suffering is a conditional aspect of life itself. It's not an absolute. Where I live in New Mexico, some of you heard about this, the first part of this retreat. Where I live in New Mexico, there are very often appearing rainbows in our monsoon season, our rainy season. And of course, a rainbow appears because of a multitude of conditions coming together at a given point in time. There's just the right amount of moisture in the air. The sunlight is just at the right angle. And then the being, me or someone else, happens to be in the right place at the right time and looking in the right direction and seeing a rainbow. And it changes very, very quickly, within moments, within seconds, actually. Everything in our life, which includes ourself, is like a rainbow. A changing set of conditions that are totally interrelated and empty in and of themselves. And it's quite obvious with a rainbow, but not so obvious with this seemingly solid body, seemingly permanent or solid in a certain way, mental phenomena. Our rainbow body, our rainbow mind. The suffering in trying to grasp on to some appearing thing, some experience, some state of mind, any phenomena, and solidifying it and identifying it as me, as mine, as ours, as who I think I am, as who I believe I am, and thinking of this phenomena as though it's all by itself. It's real. It's unchanging. An idea, even. An opinion. A belief. An emotional state of mind. A bodily experience. Solidifying it, identifying it as me, as mine, will inevitably bring suffering. Because it changes. The way of things, the nature of life, natural law, the natural unfolding of life will inevitably get in the way, will inevitably frustrate our efforts to cling on, to hold on, to solidify, to anything. Freedom, liberation from suffering, it isn't based on anything imaginary. It's not based on anything idealized. It's not based on anything pretended. It's not based on anything hoped for or wished for or philosophized about. And it's certainly not based on anything that's avoided or ignored. We can't be free from something that we don't see. We can't be free from something that we ignore. Ignorance isn't bliss. It's ignorance. Ignorance provides the fertile ground for delusion to sprout. But fortunately, both ignorance and delusion are only impermanent, conditioned states of suffering. They're not our true nature. They're just one of the hues of the rainbow. This is a piece that some of you get to hear again. The Myth of Sisyphus, Stephen Mitchell's version of it. We tend to think of Sisyphus as a tragic hero, condemned by the gods to shoulder his rock sweatily up the mountain, and again up the mountain forever. The truth is that Sisyphus is in love with the rock. He cherishes every roughness, every ounce of it. He talks to it. He sings to it. It becomes the mysterious other. He even dreams of it as he sleepwalks upward. Life is unimaginable without it, looming always above him like a huge gray moon. He doesn't realize that at any moment, he's permitted to step aside and let the rock hurtle to the bottom and go home. As we begin to step aside, no longer habitually, no longer blindly caught and trapped in old patterns of suffering in relationship to life, our heart begins to open. Our heart begins to awaken. The energy of metta, the energy of loving kindness, friendship, the energy of compassion begins to root and grow. In the process of the cultivation, in the process of prompting unconditional loving kindness, is the purification of its opposites. In the classical teachings, the opposites are called the far enemies of metta, the far enemies of unconditional love: anger, jealousy, envy, all of the various forms that ill will takes. Also, in the process of developing and deepening unconditional care, there's a purification of what are called the near enemies of metta, or what looks like love, what our conditional habits of mind sometimes mistake for love: greed, strong desire, attachment, possessiveness. The near enemies of love. There are many, many ways that we're conditioned in our cultures around mistaking attachment, mistaking possessiveness, mistaking greed for love. The media, television, songs, films, literature, all of these various venues actually promoting a confusion, promoting an anguish, and telling us, for instance, that love hurts. We've heard that so many times: love hurts. Actually, it's not love that hurts. It's the near and far enemies that hurt. It's the near and far enemies that we suffer in. Unconditional loving kindness, that love which needs no conditions to be met, in this there is no suffering. And of course, it's essentially important that we don't pretend anything in our practice, that we don't think or act out of some idealized concept of what we think a loving, compassionate person is, or how we think we should be if we're really a spiritual person. We never feel anger if we're really spiritual, right? This is something that I never tire of reading from a saint, keeping us honest, actually, keeping us honest, Mother Teresa. This is her prayer, or one of her practices that she, personal practices of hers. And it came to me in the form of the prayer that she used, the way she used it. A spiritual person, a really spiritual person. This is from her. Deliver me, O Jesus, from the desire of being loved, from the desire of being extolled, from the desire of being honored, from the desire of being praised, from the desire of being preferred, from the desire of being consulted, from the desire of being approved, from the desire of being popular, from the fear of being humiliated, from the fear of being despised, from the fear of suffering rebukes, from the fear of being calumniated, which means slandered, from the fear of being forgotten, from the fear of being wronged, from the fear of being ridiculed, from the fear of being suspected. One friend felt that kind of overwhelmed when I read it to him, like with all the work he had to do. And some people feel quite inspired by the honesty and the straightforwardness of the work we have to do. in our practice, our formal practice, our practice of life, we have the opportunity to meet, to really come face to face and to recognize the conditional states of mind that are not metta without identifying with them. Without identifying them as who we are. Through this growing and deepening heart of friendship, loving kindness, and compassion for ourselves, we can learn to accept these states. They arise, they pass. Accept them as they arise and pass. They come and go. And begin to see that, know that, and accept the fact that they are, they aren't. Sometimes they're very strong energies when they are. This expanding capacity of our heart, what the Buddha said is really what the practice is about, our capacity, the expansion and deepening of our capacity for life. This expanding capacity of our heart actually allows us to explore these conditional states of mind with less judgment, much more spaciousness, and to begin to see them as they really are. To see these states of mind in their specific, particular characteristics, and to know the universal characteristics of these states, this impermanent, ephemeral nature of any and all in each of these states. And the suffering and anguish present in becoming identified with any of these states, the identification of thinking that this is who we are, the unsatisfactoriness present in becoming, trying to grasp on to any of these and taking them on, holding on to them, identification as who we are. We begin to see the totally conditional, contingent, not self nature of these states of mind. The fact that mind states such as anger, fear, jealousy, possessiveness, attachment are conditional, contingent states. We begin to see this. They're totally dependent, completely, totally dependent on an infinite myriad number of conditions coming together in just that moment. And fear arises, or anger arises. We're also, as our practice deepens, we're also less and less inclined to spend time looking for and getting stuck in ours or another's weaknesses or faults, what we think of as our faults, our imperfections. Our own very often strong identification with these so-called imperfections, I am a fearful person, I am a weak person, I am an angry person, and locking into this, or our identification of someone else as identifying them by their so-called imperfections. Via certain emotional states. She's a sad one. He's an angry, always angry. She's fearful and weak. And giving that person that persona. We do that a lot. And we label and stick on to ourselves and to others. We can, with the development of metta, with the development of compassion, we can begin to see and know these aspects of ourselves and others with a kindness, actually, with a spaciousness, a patient awareness. And we can learn to be with ourself in ways that are sometimes more easily accessed with a friend. We're often very hard on ourselves, much more so than we are with other people. So we begin to befriend ourselves and see all of the different manifestations of emotions, states of mind in our heart, our mind, coming and going, changing with a kindness, learning a peaceful but not passive coexistence. As fear, as sadness, as jealousy, anger, doubt, wanting, clinging, attachment, just simply arise and pass. We practice with an attitude of metta, friendship, karuna, compassion. And we don't then create another layer, yet another layer of difficulty, another layer of suffering on top of what's already taking place by being averse to what's happening in our mind, our heart. Quite a few years ago, about 5 weeks into a few months of an ongoing intensive practice period that I was personally involved in for myself, I began to experience quite a painful, excruciating loneliness. My first reaction to this experience was a wanting some attention. Something from the outside to stop it, to stop this feeling. But didn't seem to be coming. There weren't any notes for me on the note board, and nobody was looking me directly in the face because I was at a meditation retreat and giving me a smile or giving me a hug. So there it was, excruciating loneliness. At one point, in the midst of this, I decided to go outside and do some walking meditation one afternoon. And as I was on my way outside, I passed the door of a friend of mine who was also sitting this retreat. The door was closed, but in front of the door was a small jar with a bunch of very beautiful flowers in it, signifying somebody's love and care for her. Well, the minute I saw those flowers, I became ragefully jealous. I mean, very painful. This is a friend, still a good friend, who I love a lot. There was even a little taste of hatred directed at her. She got those flowers. I was lonely. I felt really awful, worse than I felt before, just being lonely, having an attack of aversion from every angle. That's what it felt like. But I continued on my way out and to do some walking meditation. And I decided to face my painful feelings, which led me to do some metta practice and some mudita, which is empathetic joy, appreciative joy, taking joy in other people's happinesses and successes. So I started with phrases, repeating phrases over and over, directing them to my friend. May you be peaceful. May you be happy. May your joy increase. May the love that you get and feel never end. But what I noticed was that That's right. You have to have some new stories. You've heard all the old ones already. This is a good one. What I noticed was that I wasn't doing walking meditation. I was doing stomping meditation, kind of in rhythm. Somebody asked about rhythm with the practice. May I be peaceful. May you be peaceful. May you be happy. No love whatsoever. No joy for her whatsoever. The energy of the practice really was heavy. It was sharp. It was not painful. Not pleasant. Quite painful. And there was a feeling inside me of burning rather than love. My idealized conception of this whole thing was that I was supposed to be filling my body with love, filling my mind with love, just overflowing to my friend. Well, in the midst of this, a very sudden kind of intuitive knowing came in. And in the immediacy of the moment, I realized that I was the one that needed the metta. I was the one that was suffering. My friend knew nothing about this. She wasn't suffering. Maybe she was suffering in her own practice, but it was me that was in pain. So I turned the phrases around and started practicing in relationship to myself. May I be peaceful. May I be happy. May I be safe, etc. Over and over and over again. At first it was not easy. And slowly, slowly, after about 40, 45 minutes of walking and repeating the phrases, directing the energy to myself, my heart softened, opened. May I take care of myself wisely, joyfully. May I be liberated. I started to feel more ease, more softening, and more care. And so I decided to go back in upstairs to my room, which was just down the hall from my friend's, and go sit in my room and practice in my room by myself. Just as I opened the door from the outside to come in to the hallway that was leading to my room, my friend's door was right next to the outside door. She opened her door at the same time I came in the hallway. And she didn't see me, but she saw the flowers in front of her door. And this beautiful smile just kind of erupted on her face as she looked at the flowers. And I stood there, unseen by her, watching this happening. And I smiled. And tears came out of my eyes. It was kind of smiling tears, I could say. And accompanied really, truly then by love, feelings of love and appreciative joy for her, her getting these flowers, her delight in the flowers, and some kind-hearted person who left them for her. So a change, a radical change. It's possible. And so we begin our practice, the metta practice, and also our vipassana practice, with ourselves, with our moods, with our difficult feelings, with our beautiful feelings, and not demanding that they not be here. Emotions, sensations in the body, feelings, they naturally arise. They naturally go away. If we struggle with them, if we try to get rid of them by struggling with them, fighting with them, we're actually perpetuating them. We get stuck in them, struggling with them. So treating ourselves as a dear friend, as a good friend, treating ourselves kindly, listening to ourselves with care, with kindness. Wisdom arises when we begin to accept all the different beings, both within ourselves and outside of ourselves. rather than trying to manipulate things or ignore things. Ignore these beings, we could say. It's through this acceptance, radical acceptance, and a commitment, a very clear, strong intention to change our mind, to change our conditional, habituated ways of being, that change happens. Metta practice, it's not about covering up or covering over anger, covering over fear or jealousy or irritation. It's about changing our mind, making the choice to transform our heart, transform our mind, so that we actually embody love, embody compassion. It's a choice not to turn away, actually, not to distract ourselves, not to pretend anything, not to run away, but to stay still and be here, be present, in relationship to what is. It's a choice to see and experience things as they are, with this natural, very natural growing and deepening capacity of our heart. Unconditional love, unconditional compassion, this ability to connect, to grow, the ability to bring a healing energy to ourself and to other beings. Completely and totally natural. It's inherent in our humanness to do this, to be this. It's not anything outside of us, it's our nature. And it's here now, always. It's everywhere, available. This is from St. Francis de Sales. Be patient with everyone, but above all yourself. I mean, do not be disheartened by your imperfections, but always rise up with fresh courage. There's no better means of attainment to the spiritual life than by continually beginning again. How are we to be patient with our neighbor's faults if we're impatient in dealing with our own? One who is fretted by his or her own failings won't correct them. All profitable correction comes from a calm and peaceful mind and heart. And this is from Rainier Maria Rilke, from his book, Letters to a Young Poet. Perhaps all the dragons in our lives are princesses who are only waiting for us to act just once with beauty and courage. Perhaps everything that frightens us is, in its deepest essence, something helpless that wants our love. There's a deep ease and a kind of quiet joy that begins to pervade our life with the occasional and then more and more pervasive transformation of the energies of anger, fear, sadness, strong desire, attachment, possessiveness, I could go on, arrogance, self-recrimination. And a quote that I offered last evening, which I'm repeating, from Nisargadatta. What can make me love? A student asked him. And he answered, "You are love when you're not afraid." When these so-called hindrances to loving kindness, unconditional friendship, when they're clearly present in any moment of our life, in any moment of our practice, we can, just as we're doing here, learn to cultivate the opposites, their opposites, as an antidote, as a remedy, bringing more strength, expansiveness, and balance of heart and mind. By learning to do this, by practicing this and learning to do it, these emotional states are weakened. And we can begin to unhook ourselves from them, unhook ourselves from being caught in them, trapped in them, stuck in them. If these energies are weaker and happen less often, we can more easily be mindful with them, be mindful of them. This is a story of a student of mine from some years ago. Over a two-year period, 1996 and 97, I taught in Poland, the first in 96 for 2 months and then in 97 for 1 month. The first time, the two-month period in 96, one of the students, he stayed for the whole 2 months. He was a man in his early 40s, and he had practiced Zen for about 10 years. He'd also practiced martial arts, Aikido and Karate, for about 10 years also. At the time that I was teaching in Poland, he was a very successful businessman in Warsaw. And as the 2 months of practice went on, and he deepened in his practice, it was the first time he'd encountered Vipassana practice and Metta. I was teaching both Vipassana and Metta there. He found himself very, very interested in the Metta teachings and the Metta practices. He'd described himself to me as a man of heavy emotions. And he, in telling me this, he said that he was just like his father and his uncle, who were angry most of the time, all through his childhood, both of whom he lived with. He'd found it quite difficult and quite unpleasant to be with them, even though they were around, mostly because they were around and angry all the time. He said that as a child, he lived in fear most of the time of these two men. And yet, as he grew up, he took on the same characteristics. He was an angry man a lot of the time. There was a very deep anger. And this energy continued to be very difficult, very unpleasant for him to be with, both within himself and in relation to others when he encountered it in other people. But unlike his father, unlike his uncle and his father, he'd actually begun to see himself and to see life much more clearly than they did because of his many years of martial arts practice and his deep interest in Buddhist teachings and practice, meditation. At some point during this intensive period, two-month practice period, he decided to take on the phrase, "May I love myself completely, just as I am in this present moment." He decided to take this on as his practice for the whole year when he returned home from the two-month retreat. Because of his many years of Zen training, he changed the words a little bit, and he created a koan, which is a question that you ask yourself that can't be answered in a sort of linear, logical, ordinary way that we usually answer questions. He just changed one word. He changed, instead of saying, can I, he said, may I. Excuse me, the opposite. May I to can I. From may I love myself completely just as I am in this present moment to can I love myself completely just as I am in this present moment. He came back the next year for the month-long retreat, and he told me that he said this koan over and over and over and over again during his sitting practice and in situations at work with his employees, at home with his family. He said whenever he felt angry, enraged, he would say it. He didn't always remember, but as it went on, he remembered more and more. He said that very often, more and more, he remembered to just stop for just a second and be still within himself for just a second and repeat this koan. He said even in the midst of anger, he started being able to do this. He also said that as the year went on, more and more often, he would remember just as the feelings of anger would begin to arise in him, because he really began to see his anger very clearly and get to know it. So just as the energy would begin, before he'd be caught, swept, kind of lost in it, he would start to say the koan, may I, can I, can I. He said that when he did that, and especially as it came earlier on in the process, that the anger just seemed to dissolve before it would become fully blown. When he came back that next year in 1997, there was really quite an enormous transformation in this man. And as he described it in his life, in his relationship with his employees, in his family relationships, and in his relationship with himself. So we begin with ourselves, and we expand outward from here, eventually connecting, eventually encompassing every form of life on the planet, every form of life in the universe, those seen and unseen. We're cultivating. It's like we're cultivating the garden, a garden, pulling out the weeds. Cultivating this garden. We keep at it. We keep growing this garden through our practice. And the plants grow strong. And they flower. And they fruit. The purity of metta is an energy of great strength, great power, actually, that gives us the clear capacity of being truly connected, not closed off. There's a deep and pervasive confidence, strength, clear connection that grows, develops. We're able to be much, much more easily present with whatever is taking place, both within us and around us, with the ability to respond, to be responsible, responsible. Appropriately responsible, much more spontaneously appropriately responsible. So metta, a friend of mine wrote a poem in response to a very tense situation at a retreat center in New Mexico between the people that were living there. And he quite spontaneously one morning, I wasn't living there, neither was he, but we were visiting one morning in the midst of this difficulty. And he just jotted this down as we were sitting at the table in the kitchen one morning. I'd like to share it with you. What is love? Love is not an emotion. Neither can it be a feeling. Love is certainly not an it, nor can it be bought or sold. Like water, a universal solvent, like honey, sticks on everything. Like light, dispels darkness. Like wind, where from, where to? Like sand, ungraspable. Yet without it, there is death. Without it, there is sickness. Without it, there is struggle. Without it, there is greed. Without it, there is warring. So where is love? Everywhere. Always. In front, above, behind, below. Then here is peace. Here is harmony. Here is the golden mean. Here is the crux of the wheel. Here is the meaning of life. To love, to let go. Let go is the backside of love. And he ended it and left this on the table for everybody. The last line is, let's do it. So from this perspective, we can turn right around and face the heart, the heart of awareness itself, and ask, who loves? Who loves? There is loving. Metta. Just this. It's not mine. It belongs to no one. It just simply is. Is always available. In relation to who loves, Shantideva, an 8th century Buddhist monk who wrote a book called A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, had quite a bit to say actually about love and compassion. But I'd just like to share a little piece of his. The Bodhisattva, a being who is dedicated, devoted to awakening, a bodhisattva. The bodhisattva's vow to achieve awakening for the sake of all beings is an inevitable consequence of the sudden eruption of unconditional love in one's life. Shantideva compares such love, this eruption of unconditional love, he describes it from his own experience, a lightning flash on a dark, cloudy night that momentarily illuminates everything. And he describes himself without it, or he describes himself in relationship to it, as a blind man who has found a jewel in a heap of garbage. So in following the Buddha's advice to practice and learn to let go and live in and with the way of things through the heart of love, of unconditional care, friendship, to abide in this, to embody this. This practice within this, there's the possibility of an unpredictable explosion of metta. Our view of the world not only changes when we touch metta, even just for a second, our view of the world changes. Not only the way we feel about it, but the way we are in the world, the way we act in the world is also transformed. Our heart opens to the beauty of this world, and also deeply opens to the suffering, the anguish of others. And it begins to prompt a very spontaneous longing to assuage this suffering. Metta begins to let us know very directly, very experientially, that in truth we're not alone, but we're intimately interwoven into a seamless web of sentient life. I'd like to close the talk with a quote from Kabir, 15th century Sufi poet. "The small ruby everyone wants has fallen out on the road. Some think it's east of us, others west of us. Some say it's among primitive earth rocks or in the deep waters. Kabir's instinct told him it was inside and what it was worth. And he wrapped it up carefully in his heart cloth." Let's sit for a moment. Thank you for listening to the Dharma.